3 whiskey cokes and 3 tickets to Challengers, please. This is The Mother and the Whore. Where do you stand on whiskey coke?
I'm a whiskey sour man myself. Just because I don't need to be drinking all that caffeine late at night, it's going to keep me up.
Wow. I've literally never thought about that.
Well, you can probably handle caffeine better than me.
I can.
Do you like whiskey coke?
Yeah, I do.
It's good.
It's my solid, like, trashy drink, yeah.
Right. It is like the ultimate fraternity. No, maybe the ultimate fraternity is a Jaeger and Coke. Is it Jaeger and Coke?
Yeah. I've never in my life had Jaeger.
Oh, really?
Never. Isn't it like a licorice flavor?
Yeah, it's something that you grow out of and then you never want it again. You're probably already past the period. You're like, you probably just never need to have it.
You know, no, the ultimate frat drink is, what is it called? Three Loco?
Four Loco. No, one more Loco, Jackie.
that's what it is.
That's an energy drink. And
is it an energy drink?
It's an energy drink and an alcoholic beverage.
It is? That's disgusting.
Which to me seems like I've never had one. Like that would wreak havoc on your body because
that's disgusting.
It's an upper and a downer at the same time.
Yeah.
Welcome to Seen and Heard.
Oh, sorry. I stepped on you.
This is the podcast all about the Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time list.
It is a very prestigious list.
Of course. The list.
And a very prestigious podcast.
That's right.
We've won several awards.
We've won a Peabody.
A Nobel.
A Tony. For our musical renditions. I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
And we are back on the list this week. Well, we were on last week. No, we weren't. We did a personal print. We did a Kiki.
You're right.
So we're back on the Sight and Sound list.
What a jump.
What?
Kiki did this.
Yeah, that may or may not have been strategically planned to give ourselves a little light break in the middle between Journey to Italy and The Mother and the Whore. Oh. What number is this on the Sight and Sound list?
This is number 104 on the 2022 list, and it's number 59 on the 2012.
Nice.
So it dropped. It's not on the top 100 anymore.
I said
surprising. I know, you're like, nice.
I said nice before I even registered.
Because I said 2012. Honestly, I should say the 2012 one first.
Yeah, you should.
Forward.
That's what I in my head.
I'm sorry.
How dare you? Before we get into the movie, though, we just want to shout out. We got another really nice review on Apple Podcasts that I really wanted to read. You haven't heard this one. So
no.
This is your first time hearing this.
Let's hear it.
It says Weekly Movie Magic. It's a 5-star review. My go-to movie podcast. Jackie and Greg are a delight to listen to and bring so much enthusiasm, humor, and rich insight for the films they're discussing. Listening to their show has helped me add a lot more films to my watch list and grow in my understanding of the art of filmmaking.
Wow.
I get giddy each week when a new episode is dropping. Cheers and thank you for your magical podcast.
That is so sweet.
It's from Corey.
Thank you,
Corey. That is so nice.
I love that.
Genuinely beside myself. Aww. With this slew of really, really sweet reviews. Someone has to come in with like a 1-star and be like, fuck this shit. These
well, don't
two
give
assholes.
Them that option. Just put the idea in people's head.
That's okay. Jackie, before we get into Mother and the Whore, what else have you been watching this last week?
I was out of town, so I only saw 2 movies, and they were the movies I watched on the plane. And first it was You Got Mail, which is
The creme de la creme,
the ultimate, the perfect romantic comedy.
That's my number one.
That's your number one rom-com ever.
Yep. Uh-huh.
You know, I fluctuate between that and Harry and Sally. Harry and Sally is still in the lead, but this is like very, very close.
Harry and Sally has more substance.
Yeah.
Not much more, but some.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Like there's no silly dog in Harry and
Brinkley.
Sally. Yeah. With a stupid name like that. No, movie's a masterpiece. I love it so much.
Yeah.
I cried. I've never cried watching this movie. I've seen it like maybe 100 times.
At the end?
Several times. One, just the losing of the store really hit me.
Oh, with the Harry Nilsson song.
It's so
remember,
sad.
Remember, life is never what it seems.
So I think that's the song when she goes and visits Fox Books after the Or is it the same? It might be the same montage.
It's the same.
When she sees her and her mom twirling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I was crying.
Yeah.
Was
oh, crying. Yeah. It's great.
And then she goes and visits Fox Books and she starts crying and I start crying. And then when they're in her apartment and she says like the whole speech about, you know, it was personal to me. And I crying.
It's a beautiful movie.
It is so beautiful and like perfect.
In the supporting cast, Greg Kinnear and Parker Posey as the significant others. Yeah.
Oh. I love Parker Posey. Growing up is realizing you love the Parker Posey character.
Yeah. Where are my Tic Tacs?
And then I saw another rom-com also on the plane called Anyone But You. This is a rom-com that came out, I believe, this year. And you know what? I think while I appreciate the effort, I think I like shot myself in the foot by watching You Got Mail before because... I mean,
it's hard to measure.
What did I do? Why did I do that?
Yeah,
I don't know. What have you been watching after my very sad rant?
I saw a lot. I'm just going to name three, and I really want to zero in on one. It's a new release. It's opening by the time this episode comes out. It should have just opened wide across the country. It's the new Jane Schoenbrunn film. I saw the TV glow.
So bad.
Oh my god! I really liked We're All Going to the World's Fair. This one, though, my god!
Wow.
This might end up being my film of the year.
That's great.
It's incredible.
I love to hear that.
Jane is such an original voice. And this film, I think it's easy to kind of like, you could say Lynchian, you could say, you know, it's easy to kind of put these labels on it. But at the end of the day, it's really its own thing. And I was really gobsmacked by it.
I can't wait to see it.
Great, great film. Please, everyone see this movie. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. On the flip side of the coin, there's another kind of indie horror movie out called Late Night with the Devil.
Mm.
And this was just a pile of dog shit, unfortunately. This was the worst thing I've seen in a while. So this was terrible. I'm not even going to elaborate on that because I just don't feel like wasting breath on it. But I saw another film. When is this from? 2018 animated film that I'd meant to see for a while. Kind of stop-go animation, but done in a way you've never really seen it before. It's called The Wolf House or La Casa Lobo. I think it's from Spain. Or no, it's from Chile. Fantastic movie. I'd heard a lot of good things about it. Finally saw it. Blew my mind.
Wow.
So I saw the TV glow in The Wolf House. I'm having a good week.
Good.
Yeah, it's a good week.
Great. I just feel behind. I feel like I've been really bad lately. Like if you go on my letterbox, like Challengers is still there. That's still in my like recent. I haven't seen anything. I've been really
well. You were out of town, so
I know, but I still feel guilty. You know what? It's Sex and the City, because every night I purposefully work until like 8 o'clock, and then I'm like, well, don't want to start a movie now and be tired. Guess I'll just look at that next episode. Like, I'm just like,
I like how you get on me about watching too many Hammer movies, but then you're over there just like binging Sex and the City.
It's just so good. It's really good. And it gives, you know what? It gives me the rom-com vibe I'm looking for sometimes. I mean, some episodes are better than others.
Because it's like, that era, late 90s, early 2000s.
New York.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah.
Should we just get into this week's film?
Let's do it.
From 1973. This is Jean Eustache's The Mother and the Whore. De la merveille d'aventure qui un jour a pu nous unir, je garde malgré ma blessure l'ineffaçable souvenir. Un souvenir. C'est l'image d'un rêve, d'une heure trop brève, qui ne veut pas finir.
The Mother and the Whore, or La Maman et la Putain, was released in 1973. It was written by Jean Eustache, cinematography by Pierre Lhomme. Alexandre is a young, unemployed intellectual who hangs around the cafes in the Saint-Germain quarter of Paris. He lives with Marie, a woman who owns a clothing store. However, the film opens with Alexandre trying to convince a past lover, Gilbert, to marry him. Gilbert tells Alexandre she is marrying another man. At Café de Flore, Alexandre meets Veronica, a sexually liberated woman working as a nurse. The pair are attracted to each other and soon start an affair. While Marie is in London on business, Alexandre and Veronica spend several nights in the apartment. Although Marie is annoyed of his fling, Alexandre puts her at ease as soon as the pair have sex, and he continues to do as he pleases. Meanwhile, he becomes furious at the mention of Marie's former lover, Philippe. Alexandre admits that he beat Gilbert and that she is marrying the man who helped her get an abortion. Eventually, Veronica reveals that she is in love with Alexandre and shows up to his and Marie's apartment after a drunk night out. The trio have a ménage à trois. Alexandre ruins a dinner party when he leaves the apartment at the news that Philippe will be joining. Veronica and him eventually return, and the trio spend the evening together. When Veronica and Alexandre start to have sex in the bed next to Marie, she gets up and attempts suicide by swallowing a mouthful of pills. Alexandre forces her to vomit, then returns to bed with Veronica. Soon after, Veronica breaks down and reveals she is dissatisfied with casual sex, and actually she does not care for it. She decries the use of the word whore and expresses how badly she wants to be loved. When Alexandre walks her home, she confesses that she may be pregnant with his child and turns away his advances. He storms into her apartment and asks her if she loves him. When she says yes, he asks her to marry him, and she agrees, but says she is going to be sick. After giving her a basin to use, Alexandre slides to the floor, exhausted and distressed. That's what happens to him, right? He's sad, right? Yeah. He's fucked up.
Kind of reminds me of the end of Phantom Thread. I wonder if it was a little...
No, Phantom Thread is happy to me.
I'm talking about just like the barf. Someone's about to barf and then...
The barfing's happy in that one.
That's true. Yeah.
The film stars Jean-Pierre Léaud as Alexandre, Bernadette Lafont as Marie, and Françoise Leburne as Veronica. This was Eustache's first feature-length fiction film. Prior to this, his longest scripted film was 50 minutes. So technically, this is the first, like, really meaty one. The film is somewhat autobiographical. At the time of making the film, Jean Eustache was living with a woman who owned a dress store. Françoise Leburne was Eustache's former lover and a university lecturer, similar to the character of Gilbert. You recognize her, right?
Sort of.
Do you know where she's from?
What?
She's from Vortex.
Oh, of course.
From 2021?
22, maybe. I think it was 22. 21, 22, yeah.
I'm surprised you didn't remember.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't remember until I saw a picture of what she looks like now.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God.
Oh, cool.
Also, if you look up a picture of Jean Eustache from the time, he's wearing like the same scarf and glasses as Jean-Pierre Léaud does in the film. He also appears in the film. Did you see him for a second?
No.
He plays Gilbert's husband that they run into.
Oh, okay.
In the grocery store.
Oh.
The film was shot on a budget of 700,000 francs. Nothing in the film is improvised. Every word was performed as written in the script. The long monologues would be printed on paper that they would put on the actor's lap, or they would hold them up.
Okay, good. Because those are long.
Those are long,
okay,
right?
Good, good, good.
The film won the grand prize jury at Cannes in 1973, but was highly divisive among critics. Many called it obscene and immoral. The film had a VHS release, but only in 2021 did it have its first disc release, when Jean Eustache's son finally agreed to have the film restored and released on disc. But before that, it was kind of hard to find.
Is this on Criterion? Like, did
Must
they put it out on
be.
Disc?
Why don't you look that up for us?
No, not yet.
So who does like, who distributed it?
No one yet.
There's no disc, but yeah. I thought there was a disc.
So it's been restored, but it has not been put on disc yet.
I thought there was. Well, I'm sure it's coming soon. A little bit of sad news, or sad information. The woman who inspired the character of Marie, like the woman that owned the dress shop that he was living with, actually committed suicide after the film's release. And in 1981, Jean Eustache was partially paralyzed after a car accident, and then he took his own life.
Right, he was in his 40s, right?
Yeah, he was young. 81, so that's like less than 10 years after this movie came out. Time Out Paris has a list of the 100 greatest French films of all time, and this is number two. Guess what number one is?
Children of Paradise.
No, I think that's number three-ish. It's in the top five for sure.
Is it guess breathless?
What number one is?
Is it contempt? No. What is
those
it?
Those are all on the list, though. It is The Rules of the Game.
Oh, of course. Yes, yes, yes.
The Rules of the Game is like the French Citizen Kane.
Yeah, it is.
It's crazy. Those are my specs.
Cool. Yeah, I read something about how the script was like 300 pages.
Something like that. Something like that.
It's like a phone book.
And it, and his, I'm sure we'll talk about this in a bit, but like when people asked him what the film, what inspired him, what he wanted the film to be about was basically about how important moments in your life are kind of just mixed in with like totally ordinary ones.
Hmm. Yeah, I like that.
I like it too.
Yeah.
What are your initial thoughts?
Also, wait, I guess this was produced by Bob Rafelson. I saw his name on the Wikipedia. Bob Rafelson, director of Five Easy Pieces and King of Marvin Gardens. I was like, what? I have no idea how they knew each other or like how he came to be involved with this, but that's super cool.
Well, I know that he was involved in like the Cahiers du Cinéma and like
Rafelson?
No.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Fashion, I'm sure. Like, I think Godard also partially funded this movie.
I guess just because Rafelson's like as American as they come.
Yeah.
Like, I just wonder how that happened, but it's cool.
I wonder.
Yeah, so I'd never seen this before.
This is another one that neither of us have seen before. This was the second time in a long
Journey to Italy.
Journey to Italy.
Yeah.
This rarely happens.
This is pure.
I know.
So for years, I thought The Mother and the Whore was a book. Like, as you hear the name, The Mother and the Whore, and you're like, oh, that must be this, like, dense, like, 1,000-page, like, Russian novel. That's what I thought. And then it's on the list as its French title, so I didn't know it was Mother and the Whore.
Yeah.
Anyway, that has nothing to do with anything. Oustache? Oustache?
I think it's Oustache.
Oustache. It's not Eustache.
It is if you live in Texas.
So I've never seen one of his films before. I thought he did the film Chronicle of a Summer, but I guess that's not him. I don't know who I'm thinking
of. No, that's someone else.
Who is that?
Let me tell you. Edgar Morin and Jean Roche.
Oh, okay. It was the C-H-E.
Off. Oh, yeah, I guess.
So first, Jean Eustache. And didn't know what to expect. Didn't read into this one. Just saw the 3-hour and 40-minute runtime. And I was dreading this. So it's like, fuck. I just feel like we've done a lot of long movies lately. And, you know, with a long film, I think the only thing I heard was I saw a tiny, tiny snippet from Pauline Kael that said, like, the mundanity or something. So I was like, great, this is gonna be like Jean Dielman.
But you like that.
I love Jean Dielman, but I wasn't in the mood for it the other night.
Continue.
You know, luckily it's nothing like Jean Dielman. I mean, not luckily,
but what,
I
love Jean Dielman. What's that supposed to mean?
No, I mean, I just wasn't in the mood for a super, super slow cinema kind of experience. So I was gonna watch this over two nights because it's long as fuck. Even though we've done longer movies, it's still on.
It's hard to do on a weeknight.
It is hard to do on a weeknight. So I kind of put this off, and then I was like, okay, I'll do half tonight, half tomorrow. But the movie sucked me in so much that I just did it all that night. I did the whole thing. I only took, you know, water breaks and bathroom breaks, and I watched it all at once. Mm. Not like I want a gold medal for that or anything, but I think it's just a testament to how much I got absorbed in this. Mm-hmm. I like Jean-Pierre Léaud. Wasn't really familiar with anyone else in the movie, but instantly the movie kind of draws you in. First it was a little insufferable when he goes to Gilbert and was like, please, 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 I love you, I love you, you're the one. But I was like, oh,
that's
I was like, ahead. It's gonna be 3 hours and 40 minutes of this. But I found him endearing even though he's the ultimate fuck boy. Yeah, no, this did something for me. It really did.
Wow.
I liked this a lot despite the first 10 minutes being like, oh shit, here we go.
I'm still shocked.
Because you texted me last night. You were like,
because while watching it, maybe especially in the first hour, I was like, Greg's going to hate this.
Why did you think that?
Well, finish your initial thoughts.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, it's, I was involved in like every minute of this movie. And for a 3-hour and 40-minute film, that's kind of this, not cyclical, but it's like, it's a lot of him attracting these women and then being interested in someone else and kind of playing hard to get and playing, you know, he's,
I thought you hated that.
I kind of do. Well, it just depends how it's done. I think that the film is taking, because I think it's Ustache looking at himself, because it is so like autobiographical, and just being like, what the fuck have I been doing with my time or something. I don't know that it's like judging too harshly. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But I just, it worked for me. It just did work for me because the relationships felt natural. Mm-hmm. And I actually think the length is justified because you really do go on this ride with them, and you see as he first meets Veronica, yeah, and what that turns into, and then how he folds that into his thing, yeah, with Marie. And I think in any other film that was shorter, it might feel like it jumped into things too much, mm-hmm, but because the film is so long and has so much time to breathe, it all feels natural. And like, that's the magic trick of this movie, of like, by the time you get to the end, you're like, I've been here every step of the journey. And so,
yeah,
I really loved this.
I am completely stupefied by that fact.
I don't know whether to be insulted that you thought I would like hate this movie.
Okay. One word, contempt. When we watched Contempt, one of the things you said, it's so annoying how they go back and forth. I love you, I don't, I hate you, I this, I that. And I'm like, oh my God, Greg is going to hate this. It's just like, really, it's the back and forth romance for me. I thought you were going to hate it. And yeah, I feel like you don't really like French talky stuff.
Because it's French?
No, just that I meant French in like a genre way, not right, a language way. I just mean like, you don't, do you like sit like dialogue heavy movies? You don't.
What?
Since when do you like dialogue heavy movies? This was way too written. That's what you love to say.
No, no. I just think there's certain writers who get off on hearing their own shit. Like, I'm not a Sorkin fan, and I'm not like, you know, I love dialogue heavy films. I love, you know, like I love.
Like, do you like Romare?
Yeah, I do like Romare. Hmm. Yeah, a lot. And I love, you know, the Before films, and I mean, Cassavetes films at the end
that's
of the day.
That's true, for sure. And this is very Cassavetes.
Yeah. Movie. And even stuff that's, I love like Sweet Smell of Success, and I love those kind of very written, twisty, noirish things too. I just, yeah, there's a certain kind of written that I bounce off of. Written poorly,
mean?
Jackie. That's what it means. No. Well, whenever I feel like they're saying things through dialogue that they can't show in the film, that's when it turns me off. But never in this film did I feel like, oh, these words are going into this character's mouth because Ustache does not know how to show it otherwise. Like, I never felt that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. I think that this is a epic movie. It is, when it ended, I didn't have any more brain cells left, but not in like a reality TV way, in a way that I was like so exhausted.
Oh yeah,
I was like so exhausted. And you know, I gotta be honest, I knew I couldn't watch this at night because I knew that I was gonna have to like get started working on like the notes and stuff. So like, I had to watch it during the day. I'm not kidding you, Greg. I think I started this movie at like 2:30, and then I had like meetings and work things, and like movie ended at 10 p.m. 8 hours. I'm so clocking in at 8 hours.
It was
hours.
All cut up for you.
Yeah.
Well, that happens.
But I hate when that happens. I hate it, and it affects your viewing. And I really want to sit down with no interruptions, not having to take notes, not having to think about anything else, not having to answer the phone, and just watch this movie. I feel like I have to.
Do it right now.
I feel like I did. Okay,
here,
bye.
We'll wait. Let me press play.
But I think it's, you know, it's really fascinating. And this like post new wave kind of thing, like I feel like I haven't seen it. And we'll get into like the thematic implications of that. But I think that more than any other French New Wave movie, the look of this one reminded me the most of Francis Ha, because we talk about Francis Ha being like,
yeah,
New Wave and stuff. But like, this is technically post New Wave. But oh my God, like the mise-en-scene and something about it, the way it's just, the way that he shoots people talking really very much reminded me of Francis Ha. And I'm sure they got a lot of inspiration from this movie. And I love that. I loved seeing like Cassavetes in this. I love seeing how this has shown up in like Jim Jarmusch, which is like, oh my God, I felt it so much.
He dedicated a film to Ustache.
Yes. And yeah, I'm just overwhelmed with this movie. I think it's like, as a portrait of a lost generation or lost youth and, you know, eternal abyss and post unrest, uncertainty. It's probably like the highlight of the genre, a highlight of the genre, if you will.
I'm curious, at what point does the regular Nouvelle Vague end and the post New Wave start?
I think 70.
And what's the mark of the, like, what?
Well, I think that this movie is like a critique of the New Wave almost.
Oh.
But we can get into it.
Interesting.
You didn't see that? You didn't find that? You didn't get that?
Jackie, I hate to admit I did not see that.
We'll talk about it. But I think first, more than anything, like, this is the quintessential post May 6th. I'd say May 68. After May 68 is probably when the French.
I thought you were going to say May, December. And I was like, I think they're the same age, Jackie.
I think we need more hot dogs.
Yeah, May 68, totally. Well, it has May this 68. Whole it has so, this whole bohemian thing running through it.
Yes. And like, this is when people talk about this movie, they say this is the quintessential like post May 68 film, and that's what this is always sold as. And like, I mean, I'm sure our listeners know what May 68 is, but basically May 68 is like just unrest in France during May of 1968, student revolts, students being violently arrested by the police out on the street, like occupying buildings in the Sorbonne and other universities. And yeah, it promised to be a cultural revolution. There was a workers' revolt right after. More than 600 student barricades in Paris. Can you imagine, like, you're in Paris and there's just like student barricades, and they would hide in the cafes, and like, it was all part of it.
Were they singing, "Can you hear the people?"
That was my thought. The second I read barricade, I'm like, fuck. Cobblestones were overturned. The cobblestones in the street were overturned and people threw them at police.
That's so sad because it's so historic.
It is. But from what I understand, not too much changed. People thought it promised to be this like big cultural and political shift. But Charles de Gaulle didn't resign. His party stayed in power. And yeah, you know, I guess it led to like women's liberation, although abortion remained illegal until 1975. It led to the sexual revolution in France, which obviously is what this movie is about. But it was still kind of taboo, like, when this movie came out. But yeah, that's what May 68 is. And that's like, this movie is like, yes.
Yeah. The quintessential in the aftermath post, of that.
Yeah. How, right. What do we do now? Right. Where do we go from here?
The lost youth.
Yeah, exactly. And Richard Brody of The New Yorker. So this is where kind of he touched on the fact that this is an anti-New Wave movie. Because he's talked about this film a lot, and his big takeaway is actually that this is a very conservative film.
Right, right.
And like, it's the flip side of May 68. It's the anti new wave freedom and romanticism of Paris, you know? And there's a great line, like, and it's what I loved about it is because in the beginning you didn't know that, right? You thought it was going to be just a regular, like you said, like the kinds of movies that annoy Greg, like just like a French, like love struck guy trying to chase down girls in Paris. And he says something to Gilbert when he sits and they're having coffee. He says, you think you're recovering when you're slowly getting used to being mediocre. After a crisis, one must forget and erase quickly. And he mentions like France after the occupation, after May 68. And he says, you're recovering like France after May 1968, my love. But that's actually him. Like what he mentioned is like basically when a crisis happens and then people are trying to recover, like it's a shift towards conservatism, right? And that's him. Like that's what Richard right. Brody is saying.
Yeah.
And it's so true. Like she's the independent woman and he is the man, and she's the independent woman who is now marrying the man that helped her get an abortion. And what is he? Like, he is the one that wanted to get married. He is the one that is like super possessive. Yeah, and he says so many things that just point to it. Like he says, like, I mean, this movie, spoiler alert, is mostly talking. so we're going to be talking about conversation a lot, I think. But he says something where like, the nights when he's having his like deep abortion talk, that's the moment where Jean-Pierre Léaud really floored me, because he's never floored me before this movie.
Oh, really?
Floored like that?
Right, right.
No. And when he's staring at the camera and he's saying like, he
not
talks
even
about
in 400 Blows?
No, he's a kid.
Yeah, but he's so good in it.
He's so good in it. But no, okay, this that's is fair. Different. We'll talk about it. He talks about knights and how like today's knights are the people who give abortions, right?
Right, yeah.
And he says it like very cruel and he's like, oh,
I don't like heroes.
The vile thing that they're breaking out of the stomach. Like, he's a conservative guy. And he mentions how women used to respect men in army uniforms. Do you remember that line?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And now it's executives that they
he
fawn
says,
over.
I have the quote here, the prestige of the uniform. He talks about. Yes.
He's like I said, extremely possessive of Marie, despite him having affairs. Like, his friend is like a Nazi, probably.
Well, he talks about women's lib too all the time. Like, oh, women's lib. But
yes.
Yeah, his friend is a total Nazi. Yeah.
Casual. They see like Jean-Paul Sartre at the Cafe de Flore du Mago. I forgot where they are. And he's like talking shit about him. I'm like, who are you to talk about Jean-Paul Sartre, sir?
Yeah.
And all his records are like pre-war music. It's classical
German.
Music. Yeah.
Some German, yes.
That Sunrise Preacher. What about that Sunrise Preacher he listens to? And I had to look this up because he says like his voice reminds him of like the June 18 man. And I was like, what the hell is the June 18 man? So on June 18 in like 1940, Charles de Gaulle gave a speech from London kind of saying like, this is the start of the like French resistance. Like, I need men and we're going to do the French resistance. So like, he's literally saying like, he reminds me of Charles de Gaulle.
Oh, wow.
And, he's the one, like, he needs to get married or he's lost, right?
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. Definitely, like, Richard Brody's point about, like, that's, I think, what's so crazy about the movie is you think it's going to be about this, like, young,
freewheeling,
liberal man in post-68, but he's really, like, fucked up.
Yeah. He's angry.
And even Marie, her breakdown at the end, like, when she says, like, oh, you know, actually, free sex is not for me and blah blah blah, like that could be seen as like kind
of Veronica.
Oh, did I say Marie? I'm sorry, I meant Veronica.
I know who you meant.
I'm sorry. She also mentions that she's been like having sex for 5 years, and the movie is, I mean, it came out in 73, and if you just subtract 5 years, like 68. May 68. Yeah. And someone else, I've read something else about May 68 of like after May 68 is when like extreme right and extreme left really like came to be in France.
Right.
And so it seems like at least Alexandre for sure, like leaning towards that.
I feel like too, her German background ties into the whole
Polish.
Is it just Polish? I thought she said German.
She said Polish.
I think German and Polish.
Didn't she say it's a German name, but I'm Polish?
Oh, maybe. Yes, you might be right.
Definitely.
And her whole thing when he's like, you have sex with migrants, huh? Like,
yeah.
So, yeah, you're totally right. I think it's funny because, he's this young, fired up conservative kid. Like,
he is, even though he's like, he has the appearance of Jean-Pierre Léaud, who's like the hero of the French New Wave.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, totally.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I love, in a way, too, like that the film, maybe this film is what happened to John Voight.
Wait, what?
Because he used to be super liberal and then he became really conservative.
Oh,
and now
I see.
Giving
well,
Trump
I think
speeches.
It's just about like the feeling of being lost at sea. Like, I think it's just because he was part of May 68, right? Like, he mentions like he has that really sad story about the tear gas. Like, that part got me too.
Yeah.
That part was, again, when I saw Jean-Pierre Léaud in a new light. I really did. Because I've seen him in a lot of things, but in this one, really, like, I think it's his best performance.
Oh,
but he was there. Like, he was there. And I think it's just, it's a story about being like a malcontent in a way, like no matter what, I'm going to be against it. When it was like conservatives, I'm going to be liberal. When it's liberals, I'm going to be conservative. Yeah. No matter what's in fashion, like I'm going to do the opposite of it.
Unfortunately, I know people like this. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's of course like rooted in the like uncertainty and unrest and, you know, just doing it to do it. And, yeah.
One thing that this really did share with the New Wave films was the obsession with movies, right?
I loved that.
So many films are referenced and by him, and he equates himself as all these different, like, oh, I'm in a Chaplin film. I'm in a Murnau film.
He mentions Murnau when they're at the train station restaurant, and he's like, everyone passes through here. Like in Murnau films, everyone's passing through. They go from the country to the city.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, that's great.
He mentions like Michel Simon movies. And I was like, who's Michel Simon? It's the guy from La Talente. Do you remember like the tall sailor guy? He's reading a newspaper at one point and there's an ad for a Sergio Leone movie.
Uh-huh. I was going to mention that.
What else?
There's also a quote from him. He says, to speak with the words of others. And that's him. And then literally he says, films teach you how to live.
I loved that.
So it's like not a, it's right in line with what's his name from Breathless. Wait, what is that actor? Oh, Jean-Paul Belmondo.
Who he mentions in the movie.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm like, it's totally that character. But I think while the Belmondo character is ultimately, I mean, obviously that it doesn't turn out well for him in Breathless, but like he's cool.
He's cool.
Right?
Is cool.
That movie's not cool. That deep. Like, I don't think
it is. I think that he is imitating a movie character. And he knows he's imitating a movie character.
And obviously it doesn't
at the end of the day, do I still think he's like, I don't know.
Attractive?
Yes, he is. Obviously.
But in this film, like, he's being a movie character, but it's also, he's obviously very cine literate because all of the, you know, Nouvelle Vague and Kahi guys were super cinematic.
Yeah.
But it's like, he's not cool. Like, he seems cool and he enchants you when you first sit down with him. But one thing that struck me about him in this film is like, he would just, like, when they first go on that date with Veronica, like, he just talks and talks and talks and it's forever before he even asks her about her.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, he's so in love with the sound of his own voice, his own ideas, which are just stolen from other people and movies and art.
Yeah.
And it's like he ultimately has nothing to say.
Definitely. Definitely. Like what? And exactly. I think it's a critique of, I think it's almost a critique of this very like pretentious French persona, right? That like, I mean, I'm not saying that they're pretentious, but like this, yeah, this thing of like, you have to know everything about art. You have to know everything about literature. You have to do this. But then it turns into your whole personality and you have nothing left.
Yeah.
He even says something like, I love when he's talking about what he loves about women. And that's the other thing. Like, there's such good, the writing is so good that even when it's him trying to be like annoying, it's still kind of cool.
So, like, well, because it's him and because it's like,
so like when he says something about the thing I'm attracted to in like women are things that could be in any woman. Like it's something you could take off and put on another woman. And he says, like starring in a Bresson movie.
Yeah. Yep.
I loved that. And then the thing about the Chaplin film, that was actually very moving.
The ending.
Yeah, because he was talking about like a vision of destruction of the highway that he saw. And then like he just pictured people going nowhere like at the end of a Chaplin movie. And like that was, I loved that.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though like, I mean, he's being a kind of a pretentious asshole. But
yeah.
No, yeah. But he is, it's very interesting because the movie starts, like I said, and you think he's another, he's playing Jean-Paul Jean-Pierre Leo, right? You think he's just playing another version of Antoine Doinel. Like he's this love-struck, quirky French boy, but it's not. Like as the movie progresses and you learn more about him and you learn that he's violent. And like even at the beginning, he when he takes her that book, the very beginning, and there's a note written inside about like to the girl that wakes me up in all my dreams. And she goes like, oh yeah, like I have nightmares too. And he goes, oh, like I said dreams and you're saying nightmares. Fast forward 2 hours later when we hear that he literally beat her to the point where she broke bones.
Yeah.
Like that's crazy.
Yeah.
And it tricks you, right?
I think it's key that we never see him actually do any of that stuff.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah.
But like when the film started and when you were like, oh, brother, it's going to be one of these.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
He says other stuff. He's like, I love your neck. Have you forgotten? I love your skin. Like he says all these like cute French things.
I mean, do you get the sense that he actually cares about anybody besides himself?
Well, I think that the title is like kind of a, it's the irony of the title, right? That's what he sees them as. Like, this is the mother, this is the whore.
Mm-hmm.
Does he love his mother? Probably.
I don't know. I get the sense everything is self-serving. He's such a narcissist. I think that he wants life completely on his own terms. And even like when he's first dating Veronica and things are fresh and new and she's like, let's go to a nightclub. And he's like, I don't want to. She's like, I'll pay for you. He's like, no.
Yeah.
I'm like, you can't just do anything that she, you know what, that she wants to do.
When every time she said, let's go out to a club, bar, nightclub, and he says no, in my mind, I couldn't help but fight the feeling that that was a budget thing.
You think so?
Couldn't help but fight the feeling.
Because he's so anti-nightclubs.
You know, your analysis is probably better.
I mean,
it's a little odd. They never
go. Nightclubs, in France at that time don't look like nightclubs now in LA.
But they would
like,
still they probably need to could have like, done it. It could have been. It was probably a big spend.
Yeah. Well, they could have shaved some runtime off the movie and used the money that they would have spent on the film on maybe. The nightclub. No, I think it's a good length.
I love when Gilbert says to him, what novel do you think you're in?
Yes, yes, exactly.
I love that. I love that.
Because this is someone who already knows his bullshit from the beginning. And she's like, no, no. And we don't yet know as the audience, like, he's charming. He's like, why aren't you going for him? And it's like, let's talk about Marie. Because Marie's the person who was just stuck around. And
I love Marie.
I love her. But it's like her self-worth is so low. And obviously we see what she's willing to do to herself because of this whole situation. But her self-worth is so low to stay with this guy because she's clearly not down with this bohemian lifestyle.
What do you mean? That's her apartment.
She's not down with the open relationship part of it.
I see.
And he kind of tells her, sure, you can if you want. But then he's like, nope, Philippe or whatever is not coming over here.
I know.
So it's such a one-way thing.
Such a one-way thing.
And she keeps saying throughout the movie, like, you're hurting me. And he's like, I know. But he keeps doing it.
And then they just have sex.
Yeah. But she stays with him.
Yeah.
And cooks for him and Veronica and hosts. And
I think she likes Veronica. Like, I think like...
I think she learns to like her. Her first impression, though, is very bad.
Definitely. But I think there's some sort of a camaraderie. Like, I don't think it's sexual. Like,
right,
I think
right.
it's like...
We're both dating this shithead.
Yeah. And in a way, it's an interesting point that like all of the women work except for him. They all have jobs.
Yes. How does he even... Does she just kind of float him? She's like the sugar mama?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's the sugar mama.
He's such a
bum. I think
she's
a bohemian for sure in that like... Yeah, look at her apartment. She doesn't even have a bed frame.
Which sexually. But like,
sexually, yeah. And then like when the whole Veronica thing comes, I think that there's... She's happy to almost have found a friend, I feel like.
Right.
And he has such a great line... Where he says something, if I see, I think he's talking about Gilbert, and he's like, it's someone I despise, her new husband. And he says something along the lines of, if it was a friend, I'd be okay with it. But because it's someone I despise, you're putting me in the same category as him.
Yeah.
And that's such a great like observation to make.
It is.
And I feel like that almost applies to Marie and Veronica of like, they like each other.
Right.
They know that they have this like bond with each other. And I mean, everyone in this is miserable. And so.
Totally miserable.
They've found each other in a weird way.
That's why when anyone smiles in this movie, you're like, whoa, a smile.
I know. When he smiles, I was shocked.
And Veronica.
She smiles a lot though. She's got a cute smile. Yeah, I like when she smiles.
But she also just seems so miserable all the time.
She's always wearing black.
Yeah. And her hair is always like tightly pulled,
always.
Probably because she's a nurse, but also that's like the, it's funny because she's the most liberated character, but she's the most buttoned up, like physically.
Definitely. And she didn't have much acting experience. She was a university lecturer.
She's great.
She's so good.
She's still working today. She's,
I know.
She's been in stuff.
I know.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Marie character is really interesting. And then that, I mean, I feel like that gets into the whole sex of it all, right? Maybe he's really good in bed.
Well, Veronica says he's good enough or something.
So I don't know. I think.
Well, let's talk about.
Do you think she loves him? Sorry.
I don't think either of them love him.
Interesting. I definitely don't think Veronica does.
No, because Veronica says right off the top, like, I get obsessed for like a month or two and then I move on. Mm-hmm. So we already know what her MO is. And she does exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
She gets very attached very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's just a matter of time until it runs out. But Alexandra's whole thing is like, it's so self-serving. Like he's literally, he knows how to manipulate women so well. Like he has women in the palm of his hand because he plays this thing of this charming intellectual and he gets people interested. Obviously he's a good looking guy. He carries himself in a very confident way, very smooth way. And he knows exactly to denying Veronica sex for like the first however many dates is such a strategic move on his part to make her more obsessed.
Yes.
He knows exactly what he's doing.
He does.
And it's just like, but it's funny though, because at no point was I ever like, fuck this guy. Like he sucks. But also like, I don't know.
I think it's because it's him. I think we're just so familiar with
him.
Yeah,
it's casting.
And like,
I think it's a brilliant piece of casting.
Yeah.
Because when the wrong actor plays this role, like he would be insufferable.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love the records.
Yeah, the records are great.
The records are so great. What a great motif. We come back to it time and again. It's like the old reliable of this movie. And I really, really love them. And I love the way he uses them.
No, it's nice too because there's no score.
Yes.
It's a 3-hour and 40-minute movie. And so it's necessary to have
definitely
some musical interludes.
And I just love the sheer amount of times they go to Café de Flore and Du Mago. And the amount of whiskey cokes they drink.
This movie should have been called Cafe Society. Just kidding.
And the amount of cigarettes they smoke. Do you realize that they're smoking unfiltered cigarettes?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know how bad they probably smell?
Oh, yeah. Believe me.
And yet they all just want to hump each other.
Whenever I watch, because they all smell bad.
Whenever you watch Mad Men, same.
No, whenever I watch any movie where people are smoking or whatever, I'm like, oh, God. Like... It always looks cool, but like...
They look so fucking cool. Like, that's the thing about this movie, is despite it all, despite it being a critique of cool, romantic, open love, open sexuality, I'm in France and I can screw anyone I want, it does all that, but it still manages to look so enticing. And yeah, I want to live in it.
Like, well, no, of course. I think that's key. I mean, first of all, it's a time and an era that you cannot... A time and place you cannot go back to. It's lost in time. It's a time that's very romanticized.
Yes.
And also, it's like, it has to look kind of appealing, right? Because otherwise you'd be like, why are these characters continuing to indulge in all this stuff? So it has to look nice. One thing really shocked me about this movie, and one thing I really, really love about it, is the frank depiction of sex.
Yeah.
And talk. I mean, you don't see so much, but it's all... talked about very explicitly.
So much. They even say, like, you know, I think you should be fucked up the ass.
Okay, like... damn it. That was, I wrote that down.
Go ahead, read it. It would do you good.
Yeah. He should get fucked in the ass. It'll do him good. Yeah. That made me laugh so hard.
That made me laugh. And then the whole tampon thing.
Okay, yeah, what the hell? Wait, was it... Is this a period thing or is it a French thing of like constantly having sex on her period? Because he has to take the tampon out.
It happened to her before, remember? Yeah.
And they mentioned bloody sheets. And I was like,
she was on her period. Yeah. When they had sex.
But I'm like, what the fuck? No shade to anyone. I know.
More people have period sex than you.
I know. It's been normalized. I know. I'm not trying to shame anybody.
No, I know you're not. But like, I feel a similar way. I mean, I could never, but
yeah, maybe we're just prudish Americans, but it's just like, yeah, because it kept happening.
Maybe she likes it, maybe she gets off on it, but you're so right. She is this prude, she looks very homely from the outside, and yet she is talking about fucking. She's not talking about having sex, she's not talking about making love.
Do they ever say making love?
Only fuck,
right? Yeah, it's fuck,
and she says it so many times, it's shocking,
yeah.
And it's so good. Like, it's just, it's so off guard. And then her whole plight, like, I feel for her so much. And yeah, I love that. Like, yes, she is a liberated woman. And I think it just goes to show that liberated woman isn't as simplistic as you just have a lot of casual sex. Like, that's not all there is to it. And I think that she's an example of a character who maybe was told that. And while she enjoys sex, like, just watching her break down at the end and like, prove that that's false is so moving.
Yeah.
And I love it. I love her monologue.
Because you're witnessing a genuine shift for this character. Yeah. Like, her life will not be the same after this night.
No. And I feel like, well, I also feel the same about Marie. Because when Marie is alone, I don't want to say too much. When Marie is alone, she listens to that song.
Yeah.
I sense a shift in her too. Like, I don't think he's going to go back to living with her. Do you think?
See, that scene could be taken one of two ways. One, it could be like, this is the final straw for her. And like, this is not going to happen anymore. Like, she's done. She's finally done with him. It could also just be the mundanity of her sitting while him and Veronica go off. And she's just staying with her.
She's crying.
She is crying.
Like, but she covers her face.
Yeah, but she's upset all the other times too. And he still does it. Like, what would make this time different? Because of Veronica's monologue?
Well, I think Veronica's monologue... And also the fact of the matter of, I think they at least plan on getting married.
Right.
Don't know if it's going to happen.
I don't
obviously
think it's
won't last, but happen, possible.
I don't know that it's going to happen. I think this is his last night with Veronica. I don't think he's going to see her again after this.
I think she's so, so longing for love and companionship that, like, I think if it were up to her, it would happen. Like, I genuinely, I don't think it's real love, but I think that she thinks she loves him.
But I think the kind of love that he's into, like, she realizes is not sustainable for her. And she's also seen what it has done to other women that he's loved. And
it's true. It's also, we're not even considering the fact that she's like hysterical at the end.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about she's that laughing. Scene. She is laughing. Yeah. She completely breaks down. You're right. To touch on that, on the hysteria too, when Marie tries to, when she takes the pills.
Oh my God.
And Veronica's like, just let her do it.
I know. That seemed a bit out of character.
A little bit. I was like, does she fully grasp like the gravity of this situation?
That seemed a little out of character, especially because it seems like they like each other. Mm-hmm. They do. They genuinely like each other. I don't think she would want her to kill herself.
Yeah.
I think maybe that part falls a little bit into satire for me.
Satire.
A little too much. Because then they just go back to having sex. It's like.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I did clock that.
But at
that.
First
that
she's was like, what's little, wrong with you when he tries to have sex with her again? But I'm like, bitch, you're the one that said let her do it.
Yeah, that's true.
So I feel like that part's maybe a little.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's important too to note this came out in 73. It's right around the same time as like Last Tango in Paris and stuff. So this movie was scandalous when it came out, but movies were getting scandals everywhere.
Right.
And Last Tango was a big hit. Yeah. Like Marlon Brando talks about like fucking a pig corpse in that or something.
Have you seen it?
Yeah. Pauline loves it.
I have to see it.
I don't share that with her. Although I'm very curious to see it again. But I saw it. I've seen it once. I thought it was trash when I saw it.
Trash?
Yeah. Like I hated it. But there's a whole scene where Marlon Brando's like, oh, fucking a pig and fucking it's like bloated. And I'm like, what?
That sounds awful. Anyway,
but yeah. But this movie is, I really, really do love the way that it handles all of that stuff because it is mostly kept to dialogue and the film does fade out when people start to have sex. But you get enough in there. You get the before and you get the after.
You get the dread.
You get the dread, exactly. Like, you get all the feelings of it without actually seeing the actual sex.
You don't get, I would argue, I don't even get any sexiness.
No.
I don't really get.
No.
Not really.
You kind of get the impression that these people are just
doing it to do it.
They're engaging in it compulsively.
Yeah.
Almost like nymphomaniacs.
Yes, yes, yes,
not,
yes.
Again, not to put anybody down. I'm just like, because especially for Veronica, there seems to be no joy in it.
No joy. It's like,
I want to have sex. He's like, I'll see you tonight. So she goes and gets fucked somewhere else. And she's like, I needed a cock. She literally says that. She's like, I needed to get fucked. And it's like, it doesn't matter who it's attached to. It's. And it needs, when she wants it to happen, it needs to happen now. And that's like all the, like, nymphomaniac.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he kind of is too, but his denying people of it is his whole thing of like, because he knows it's just going to make them want him
and
more.
And he uses it with Marie. It's like, every time they fight, they just fucking make up.
It's a tool.
When Veronica comes over that night drunk, did you see that coming?
No.
Really?
No. That actually shocked me.
I was waiting for it.
And just like, whoa, here we go.
Well, I was waiting for it because IndieWire released an article when Challengers came out saying, did you like Challengers? Watch The Mother and the Whore. And I was
wow.
Like,
that's serendipitous timing right there.
I know.
With the ping pong.
Ping pong. It does that.
Yeah, this is way better than Challengers.
The movie also has these really good like truisms around about love that I really love, for lack of a better term. I love when he's saying, like, he's talking in the beginning and he's saying, the day I'll get over this, I'll be a different person. And I don't want that. What he's talking about, like, and he says, like, that day we won't be able to meet again. And he's telling, like, Gilbert that. And, like, just the way that fact about, like, the way that you hold on to pain, because you're going to be a completely different person when you're over this. Like, that's crazy. I love that. I love what he says about, you must turn some people off to turn others on so much.
Yeah. That's true.
So true. There's all the, yeah.
That's something I learned over time too. Like, I'm a very agreeable person. I think both of us are.
Yeah.
And like, that's something I learned. I'm like, I don't need to be so agreeable. Like, I can lean into myself a little bit more. And like, yeah, some people will be like, fuck this guy. But then, yeah, you're always going to piss. If you're doing it right, you're going to piss some people off.
Yeah.
Some, you know. So go ahead, say something scandalous right now.
I'm trying to think. I don't think birds should exist.
We've heard this a million times from you. I love to what he says to Gilbert. Gilbert Gottfried, when he tells her, like, this is so insidious. He's like, well, you're gonna have a daughter and you're gonna raise her. She's gonna look like you, and then she's gonna be with me because young women like older guys. And like, that's such a shitty thing to say.
Such a shitty thing to say.
It's like gross. Maleficent. Like, I will come back when you prick your finger on a spinning wheel
on your
16th birthday or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. I love what Veronica says about love isn't like that. When he's talking about Alexander and Marie, she says something where it's like, love isn't like that. It's simple. When it ends, it's not shitty.
Mm.
And I just love that so much. And then she says something like, you do love her. Like, you wash with her, you shit with her, you live with her.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was great too. The movie's, it's so well written.
One of my favorite scenes in the movie, and I guess the most illustrative of the mother, is when he goes to her shop and she picks out that scarf.
And puts it on him.
And puts it on him.
She's wearing the sunglasses.
And then he immediately goes and kisses her.
Yeah, I love that.
It's like, that's the function that she serves, is that she watches over him. She has his best interests in mind.
Yes. Yes.
Oh.
So yeah, I don't know if he loves her, actually. I take back my... I think he does have a soft spot for her, though.
Well, sure, soft spot.
No, I think if he loves anyone, it's probably her.
Marie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She takes care of him.
Yeah.
She makes him food.
Rabbit in mustard sauce.
That sounds disgusting. Actually, I don't think I've ever had rabbit.
I don't think I have either.
I don't like lamb. If it's anything like lamb.
I don't think it is.
Okay.
I think it's more like chicken. I just love rabbits.
Yeah. It would be too weird for me to eat rabbit. Yeah. Sight and sound?
Yeah.
What's your favorite sight?
So... there's a lot. I absolutely love the sight of Marie opening the door the first time Veronica comes over, and there's a mirror behind her. Do you know the shot I'm talking about? She opens the door. So at first we can only see her, but when she opens it, they're there.
Yeah.
Love that shot. I love just the shot of Marie in her shop with her sunglasses, just looking like bored out of her mind. I love Veronica's monologue. I love the shot where he first notices Veronica when he's walking past all the tables, and then the camera kind of turns around. It's just this like sad woman all in black sitting there. It's so funny. I thought the movie was about an actual, like, I thought she was a prostitute.
Right.
So I thought like she was just trying to pick up a customer. But my favorite is a sight. It's a sight and sound combined.
Mine is too.
Is it the same one?
I think it's different. So mine, my sight and sound, it's both. I think you picked a record one. I think when Marie is listening, my favorite one is when Veronica is listening the first time. I think they sleep together and Marie's in London or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's the shot of her and she's up, she's like sitting against the wall, and it's like that Marlene Dietrich record, or the woman that sounds like Marlene Dietrich. And it's just her like listening to it, and her face, she crying.
Smile, I feel like.
Oh yeah.
Is it when her hair is down?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. And then he's
humming.
He's like singing along with it a little bit, but I just love that.
It's great.
So I tried to pick a nice moment from them.
That is a nice moment.
Here it is.
Il n'y a plus de fortifications. Mais il y a toujours des chansons.
And in a twist of events, in a twist of fate, I chose the not as nice moment.
Yeah,
it's,
wow.
I mean, it's got to be the Edith Piaf song. It's at the end, it's so sad. It encompasses the whole movie. It is the whole song.
I was about to say,
the shot stays on her the whole song from her like staring to covering her face. The song is Les Amants de Paris, which is the lovers of Paris, and like the lyrics are literally about them. It's like, I don't know, it said something about the lovers of Paris lie down with my song, in Paris lovers love each other in their very own way.
Yeah.
And I think it's just the whole movie, it's just complete cracking of the illusion of that open and free Parisian love and romance. And yeah, I think it's just the whole movie.
Let's play a little clip.
It's the sight and sound is the whole movie, I would say, not just the sound, because the sound is just the song.
Right.
But you have to see her.
You do. Shit.
What a movie. I want to watch it again.
Watch it again.
It's so long.
I know, it is long. I have to say, though, for a 3-hour and 40-minute movie.
That is all talking.
It went by faster than any other movie that length. So it's like, that's like Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
This is like longer than Godfather 2.
Wow.
And Lawrence of Arabia, you definitely feel the length.
Oh my God, yeah.
You're supposed to. This, I didn't really feel it.
I didn't feel it either.
Yeah.
You don't realize how long the scenes are.
Yeah, exactly.
Until when I went back and like was doing notes and stuff.
Yeah.
Pauline
Kael. Okay, so we have a hefty little snippet from Pauline.
Ooh, a treat
today. Here's what Pauline Kael had to say about The Mother and the Whore. Art and disgust are closely related in the thinking of a number of modern filmmakers of religious background. Paul Morrissey's films seem to be made by a dirty-minded altar boy, and the concept that messy anguish sanctifies is at the very heart of Cassavetes' films. The Mother and the Whore is not a negligible film. It's unmistakably a personal expression, and it does achieve moments of intensity. No doubt some people will say more than moments, and some will consider Veronica's ultimate monologue cathartic, though the fact that it signals reprieve for the exhausted viewer may contribute to that feeling. The 3 hours and 35 minutes feel so long that you want to think you've had something to show for it, and catharsis is big stuff worth squirming for. Mm. It's contrary to what we just said. But is Alexandra ultimately moved to ask Veronica to marry him because he's a fool who loves grand gestures? Or are we really meant to believe in the authenticity of what she represents? For me, it was as if Alexandra were pressured into confessing a crime he hadn't committed.
That's interesting.
Veronica rants so much that finally he assumes the guilt for all the men whom this obsessive woman has landed in bed with and then felt lacerated by. He assumes the guilt for the whole world's failure to love. Alexandra may be just trying on his new deep feelings, but she, I'm afraid, is intended to be the real thing. Interesting. It turns out that Ostache is a sin-ridden bohemian of an earlier school and that the movie is about the penance that must be done for sex without love. Mm. He has welded together the disaffection of a generation and his own sexual disgust. Isn't that really what Veronica's diatribe is all about? Isn't she really saying, I want to be loved? I suspect that that's why the movie will appeal to people who feel stranded in a confusion of personal freedom and social hopelessness. Mm. Antonioni explored the theme of sex without love, but he placed it among the affluent. In placing this theme among the students and those who go on living like students, Ostache makes direct contact with the movie audience. Antonioni's bleak atmosphere spoke of spiritual emptiness. Ostache's atmosphere is like a spiritual mange, and probably many people in the aging young movie audience feel mangy and lost and degraded, and have had their share of miserable sex experiences. They may be willing to embrace Veronica's loathing of her life, and perhaps willing to look to the healing power of Christian love. The film is designed to be a religious experience, but the musty answer it offers to the perils of sexual freedom is actually a denial of sexual freedom. In The Mother and the Whore, the new wave meets the old wave.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is very interesting. She said something about he takes on the guilt of everyone who's ever like had sex without love.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, I like that too.
Very well said.
Yeah, no, it's... and her review for this is like 6 pages too.
Damn.
Yeah, kind of spot on the money, except I didn't feel every minute of the runtime.
I didn't. Oh, well, I kind of did, but that's because I had to like break it up.
Yeah. I started this at 8:30 at night and it finished at midnight.
Okay, that's
just after midnight.
Spot on.
Letterboxd?
Should we do Letterboxd?
Let's do it.
This ought to be interesting. 2 stars. Quirked up guy smokes cigs and tries to have sex with different mid women. Kind of a bore, unforch.
Mid women?
Unforch. I don't think they're mid.
They're beautiful. They are beautiful. 5 stars. Does Jean-Pierre Léaud ever have a future?
It's true. It is true. Love him. 5.5 stars. The Frenchest thing I've ever seen.
It kind of is. 4.5 stars. Can't believe this is 3.5 hours long and I haven't been bored one bit. Surprising how much I loved it. I went in thinking I'm going to hate it, but I was wrong. I loved every second of this. I kind of felt similarly. Like,
yeah.
I sucked into this thing. I really got sucked in like a Dyson vacuum.
Why Dyson?
I don't know. Because it's top of the line. Just like this movie.
Yeah. I'm still so shocked you like this movie. Okay, here's a 2.5. Way too self-indulgent and long for my liking. All the characters are, by design, reprehensible and repulsive. That could have made for an interesting conflict, but it's blah dialogue, and frankly, I get impatient when it takes 3.5 hours for a protagonist to complete his arc. Visually, it's flat and dull. There's no score. The only musical accompaniment are the records the characters put on to play when they're bored or have nothing to say. Maybe if it were half the length, I would have been more lenient, but hardly any film has the right to be this drawn out.
That's the whole point, though.
I think it is the whole point.
Also, because
you're supposed to be really tired. Exactly. Pauline was right. That moment of catharsis when Veronica breaks down is very moving.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And it's like a 10-minute monologue, maybe.
Yeah, 2 shots. One of them is over 5 minutes long, apparently.
Yeah, it's great. I just think... I'm sorry. I don't know. I think after you see stuff like Jean Dielman, which again, we both love, it's a masterpiece. It's a great, great film. But once you see something that's truly tedious, as that film is supposed to be tedious, this movie, it's a breeze.
Yeah. Do you have another one?
Yeah. 5 stars. The Fuck Party, 1940 to 1972. At almost 4 hours, this has the room and the audacity to create its own sense of time, miles apart from customary movie time, and where emotions can stretch, grow, and be examined in the space of a song on a record player or a protracted late-night conversation, soul-bearing session.
Wow, I love that.
It's well said.
5 stars. Is this what life was like before YouTube Let's Play? Is YouTube Let's Play a thing, or was there supposed to be a break there?
Yeah, Let's Play. I think it's like when you watch people play video games on YouTube.
That's what Let's Play is.
I think so.
Fuck that shit.
You're young. You're supposed to know this, Jackie.
I don't know any of this.
You telling me you don't stay up till 3 a.m. and watch people play I almost said Fallout. What's the...
Mario Kart?
No. Mario Kart's fun. What's the one all the kids... Oh, Fortnite. You don't stay up till 3 a.m. and watch people play Fortnite on YouTube?
5 stars. Everything in the similar film section feels redundant after this, which is interesting. Because if we're buying into this whole, like, this is the anti-New Wave, did this ruin New Wave? It didn't. Not for me. But
nothing could ever ruin New Wave for you.
Nothing could ever ruin Paris or New Wave or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I get what they're saying, just in the sense of like the related films on Letterboxd. I'm not sure what they're talking about. Know. I'm sure it's not a lot of new wave films that are being recommended. I'm sure it's like stuff like Last Tango in Paris. And actually, let's look right now.
Is that a Letterboxd setting? I don't even know about this.
It's at the bottom.
Really?
So if you're on the page for a movie and you go down to the bottom, it's a similar film. So the first one that comes up, Jules and Jim, Before Sunset,
Love in the Afternoon,
Closer, The Dreamers, Blue Valentine, Vive Sa Vie, Blue is the Warmest Color.
None of these are redundant. Worst Person in the World. I love all of these movies.
Eternal Sunshine, Scenes from a Marriage.
These are all masterpieces.
One sings, the other doesn't.
Scenes from a Marriage.
No, these are all very different films.
And I love them and they're not redundant.
There's a certain, I think what I like so much about this too, it feels definitive in its subject matter, right? I think in terms of films that explore a kind of open relationship or kind of like a threesome.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of movies to do. The Dreamers was on there and other films, you know, where it's like a kind of polyamory, right? That's what it's called.
Love triangles.
Yeah. Well, but a love triangle is almost just like, it's like, I think Casablanca. It's like, but in terms of three people actually like sleeping together, living together for a while.
There's this one, it's called Design for Living. It's by Lubitsch.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's true. Yeah. But this, in terms of that genre, this feels pretty definitive.
Yeah.
Because it just feels so natural.
Itu Mama Tambien. But that's just one part of Itu Mama Tambien.
Well, and that's like a more traditional love triangle of like two guys lusting after one woman who's leading both of them on. Right. And I'm not going to spoil anything that happens at the end of that movie for people who haven't seen it. But also, if you haven't, go see it right now.
Yeah, no, that's one of my favorite movies.
It's so good.
This was really fun.
Yeah.
Good movie.
Yeah, really good movie. I'm glad I saw it.
Pleasure speaking to you about it.
Your text last night, you gave this 4.5 stars? I can't believe it. It's like, yeah.
I was shook.
Yeah, because I think that sense, when it finishes, you do sense you've seen something profound.
Definitely. I think so.
And it does validate your time spent with it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, good film. Great film.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. What's next week? It's a s'mores episode. It's going to be a weird Western.
Yeah, weird Western. That's the theme.
So come back next week for a little s'mores action. I can't believe it's already time to do s'mores again.
That's so weird.
This month was short.
I feel like we just did Midsummer like 2 weeks ago.
I know. Well, until next week, I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Special thanks to the patrons at our highest tier, John Pennington and Cynthia Fordwell. Seen and Heard is an official podcast of the Arroyo Film Club. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to drop us a line, you can find us on email at hello@seenandheardpod.com or on Instagram @seenandheardpod.